Welcome back, everyone, to another episode of the Superpowers Podcast. Our show is simple. Tell stories from the trenches, understand our guest journeys and what leads to their success, and ideally, we unearth their unique superpowers. Everyone has a superpower. What's yours? Enjoy the show. Welcome back, everyone, to another edition of C2 Ventures in the Trenches. We have a really special guest with us today with Matt and I, Jamie McGurk, who's someone I've known for a long time, most recently at Andreessen, currently with BAM Elevate as a general partner. We'll learn a little bit about his investment philosophy thesis and what he's doing over at BAM. Obviously, we have my better half, long-haired Matt, who looks a bit showered today, which is good for us. Matt's been obviously writing quite a bit about the state of the market, macro headwinds, obviously a hot topic for everyone, not just venture, but founders. On this segment, we're going to get Jamie's perspective as it relates to what he's seen in the markets and how they're thinking about investing, obviously much larger platform. But without further ado, Matt, I'm going to pass it over to you.
Well, Jamie, just give us the quick and dirty for context here for the listeners. You know, where BAM invests and what kind of stuff you guys look at.
Yeah. So BAM as a firm is a $16 billion asset manager, primarily focused historically in the public markets. And in the public markets, we invest across a few different strategies. One is equities, so long, short, fundamental equities, macro, credit, and commodities. So those are the four public strategies. I joined the firm a little over a year ago to start our private investment business. And in our private business, we focus on growth stage technology growth companies. And that's a very broad waterfront of companies, of course. Within our group, we have resident expertise across enterprise, fintech, and consumer. And then as a firm, we have a large platform. And on that public side, they cover, and the equities business cover all industries. And so that gives us a lot of reach into adjacent areas. So for example, we've invested in industrial software companies, and we've used the expertise that comes out of our industrials team as one example to understand and ultimately invest in companies that are in that space. And that's true across different areas as well. So being part of a larger platform, one of the big benefits is you get a lot of different reach and resources, and that's how we utilize it at BAM Elevate. But ultimately, we're looking for growth stage technology companies that have a software element to them typically, but generally fall into enterprise, fintech, and consumer categories.
Okay. Thank you. That's helpful. And do you guys have a particular expectation when you come into a company around like time to liquidity, time to exit, I guess, just to put it another way, and any specific kind of return target that you guys are looking for?
Yeah. So on the first part of that question, we don't. I mean, other than every investor to some degree has some expectation of timeline, but I think how we get categorized generally is into a crossover bucket. Okay, they're a public investor and they're investing in privates. Now that must mean that they're doing pre-IPO type rounds and, you know, they want to be liquid in a year or 2 years or something like that. And that's not the case for us. We are focused on private markets, really starting at beyond the venture stage. And it's hard to exactly characterize what that means. But, you know, from my background, you know, Series A and even, you know, to some degree a Series B investor, they're taking technology risk, they're taking product risk, they're taking market risk. And so, you know, a lot of times in a seed Series A round, like you guys invest in, you know, companies don't have products yet, or they haven't gone to market yet. So you don't know if there is acceptance and product market fit. We're typically investing after that stage. And sometimes that can be a Series B for a more mature Series B stage company. Sometimes it's a Series C. Sometimes it's a Series A. So the letters don't always correspond, but think of us as like an early growth investor. And dovetailing back to your question, our expectation on return timeline or time to liquidity, if we're entering at that stage, you know, our time horizon can be 5 or more years. When we have the ability to invest all the way up to pre-IPO. So it depends on what we're underwriting. If we're underwriting something that is a pre-IPO round, our expectation can be sometimes in the 6 to 12 months. That goes well with your second question, which is what type of returns are you looking for? And I'd say this also varies. If you're put into a general category of like, oh, they're a crossover investor, they're trying to beat the S&P 500. that's true of some crossover investors where that's their benchmark across their entire investing strategy. For us, we look at it as when we're doing a late stage deal, we're investing out of, you know, a sleeve of a larger public fund. And so, you know, so we're underwriting those very differently than we are something that is more IRR based at a shorter time period. So
you guys will come in for the first time on a pre-IPO, or you typically get a start early and then just then do follow on rounds?
We will, and we can, and we have. I would say, you know, when we're at our best and we're kind of looking at, you know, the right types of things for us, we're kind of entering in that, you know, early growth phase. And then we are using our additional firepower at later stages to support those companies up to being public.
Yep.
So for a first check, we are most often entering in more of the earlier growth phases. That can be, you know, as I mentioned, that kind of Series C, Series D or so on. It's typically not at that pre-IPO phase. I mean, I think that's a really tricky spot to focus. And, you know, you've seen it over the course of the last 6 months, like really be highlighted from last year's pre-IPO rounds. And so we haven't done a whole lot there. And I think most of what we would do there in the future is supporting our companies as they're at that phase, companies that we've been involved in for a long time.
Hey, you know, three years ahead of an IPO is technically still pre-IPO.
Exactly. I mean, every private company is a pre-IPO company that come public. So,
all right. Well, thank you for that. That's very helpful, I think, context for where we're going to go with the discussion. So let's, you know, start with kind of your broad views of the market today and where you've seen the biggest changes. And you go wherever you want here. It could be, you know, deal flow you're seeing or competition for rounds or valuation or all of the above.
Yeah. Well, so there's been dramatic changes in all of those areas. You know, I would say you rewind the clock a little bit. 10 years ago, we just passed the 10-year mark for Facebook's IPO. And I would say Facebook's IPO was a bit of a watershed moment for the private investing landscape. So previously, when you thought about private investing and, you know, growth investing and pre-IPO investing is not a new thing, it's not a new term, but certainly the activity and the number of players and frankly, the amount of capital that has been available in the private markets and really at the growth stage has changed pretty dramatically. And that was really brought about by not just the Facebook IPO, it was really Alibaba and Facebook were the two kind of poster examples of what started this trend. And that trend was like, these are really large market dominating, category creating technology companies that stayed private a very long time. So you've kind of heard this term over and over, the stay private longer type thing. And it was really kicked off by those companies. And, you know, a lot of public investors that in a previous generation, if you look back to, you know, Google in, you know, went public in 2004, if you look back to, you know, Amazon and all the big companies of today, and you look at their journey through the private markets, they raised a very modest amount of venture capital. I mean, some, like, you know, you go a ways back, I mean, Microsoft raised $1 million of private capital before going public. So the vast majority of the returns were realized in the public markets for those companies. And that all changed with, you know, Facebook and Alibaba, really, where, you know, the vast majority of the value creation was made by, you know, the venture capitalists, the private investors. And that ushered in a period of like, okay, well, if all of this value is going to be created in the private markets, then we have to, you know, go and seek, you know, the alpha where it's being made. And that's in those private rounds. And so back in, you know, 2012, 2013, you really saw, and it's not the first time it happened. Like I said, you know, there were some select mutual funds, obviously other private growth funds, but other public investors that were doing it before, but not to the same degree that you saw starting then and really continuing on till, you know, to today. And so after that moment, you really had a lot of private investors that came into the market, and it wasn't all at once, but, you know, starting in 2012, you saw some of the hedge funds that set up private investing arms, which was, you know, kind of a mistake that they made the first time around, or some made the first time around, was investing in illiquid securities and liquid vehicles. And 2008, 2009 timeframe saw like the downside of doing that. And so for the first time, they structured private vehicles. So these were like a lot of the public investors that stood up, you know, dedicated capital call draw funds that were designed appropriately to invest in private companies. And that all started in the 2013-14 timeframe. And they were very active. And then the mutual funds became more active. And so not just Fidelity and T. Rowe, but like a whole new class of the different mutual funds were active participants. And then you saw names like SoftBank and some of the larger structured funds come in. And that's continued on until, you know, we'll see today as we see here in 2022, but certainly through the end of 2021, you had lots of competition. It came from lots of different areas. So I mentioned hedge funds and mutual funds, and not to mention the other, you know, traditional growth equity platforms that were in the market. But then you had like sovereign wealth funds that were traditionally just LPs, and they, you know, stood up direct investment businesses, as did family offices and other types of LPs. So there was a lot of competition in the market, and, you know, 2022, we're seeing less of that, but certainly just speaking through the end of 2021, it was the most active part of the market with the most number of deals and really, you know, a lot of concentration in the growth stages, but even seeping down into a lot of these players, like kind of broaden their strategies to include the venture stage too, which is something that I never predicted would happen, but certainly has happened. And, you know, we've seen a reversal of a lot of that in 2022. So starting with competition, so less active investors that are in the market, therefore that's had an impact on valuation. I think it's had more of an impact, frankly, on the deal velocity. So there's less deals getting done in the private markets now. It's not like the same amount of deals are getting done at significantly lower prices. I think the private markets are, there's a psychological lag time. Sort of like, okay, like it's not directly correlated one-to-one to, you know, valuations in the public market. You can have a look every single day or every single minute and see where those are. In the private markets, it lags. And so, you know, there's always been the traditional, like, well, it takes 6 months for it to really seep down into private markets. I mean, those times have compressed. As you've seen, the one of the biggest drawdowns now in the public markets has taken, you know, all of 6 months. The private markets have not caught up to that yet, but that certainly is starting to happen. But there is noticeably, significantly less activity and therefore less competition for private growth rounds today.
Okay. But as you guys, so I assume you guys are seeing some valuation compression, but it sounds like not that material yet.
So I would say we're seeing valuation compression where there's deals to be done, but it's not a broad reset for every company, because the, you know, the silver lining, if there is one, for the last 2 years for private companies is it was, you know, one of the most robust funding environments across the board. So it's not like you had this top decile company that was going out and getting, you know, a fantastic valuation and raising a lot of, you know, a lot of capital. You basically had all companies where the markets were open for on the private side. And so over that period of time, you know, which is something that I've never seen over the course of the last, you know, 2 decades, which is a single company going out and raising 4-5 rounds over the course of 6 quarters, each one at a significant step up from the one before. And so what that resulted in is exiting 2021, private companies had really strong balance sheets. Now, a lot of them had operational expense plans that were, you know, that were wound up to match that. But, you know, some of that unwind will happen, but not all of them. And so you had very, very strong balance sheets for a lot of the top performing companies, private companies. And so what will happen then is you won't see a valuation reset. So it's, you know, these companies are like, okay, well, we don't have to go out and raise capital. We're not going to go out and raise capital. And, you know, it'll take time for the fundamentals of the business to catch up to the valuations that they got the last time they raised, but they have the balance sheet to be able to do that. And so I don't think you'll see a slow grind. And of course, you know, there will be companies, and there are companies out that need to raise, and, you know, fundraising is the lifeblood of startups, as you all well know. I think it'll just be a little bit tempered because there has been so much capital that's been deployed into the system. So there won't be that need to go out and raise on a normal cycle that you've seen in times past.
Okay. So I know this is an unfair question to ask. I'm gonna ask it anyway, because every company is obviously situations are unique, but if you were to look at the broad average of at least what you kind of have transparency into for companies, am I to understand that you're pretty confident that at least sort of the majority will be able to dial back those operating plans sufficiently that they can grow into their valuations before they have to raise again. Meaning, you know, we should not expect to see a lot of sort of flat or down round type raises or.
So I think it depends. So the best performing companies that had, you know, really strong unit economics and the business was working and they were raising, you know, because they could, or they were raising, a lot of these rounds were preempted. So they weren't out looking for capital. There were investors coming in wanting to give them capital. And so that's the reason why you had, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 different fundraisers over 2 years for a single company. I think where I would be a little bit cautious in seeing, you know, these down rounds that do materialize in a shorter period of time is companies that hadn't yet worked out the economics of the business, unit economics, or really built a big business. We're more kind of growing for growth's sake. And a lot of that, frankly, was being pushed by investors to pursue growth. And so, you know, unprofitable growth, frankly, and not just profitable, like uneconomic growth, I should say. Mm-hmm.
Jamie, how does that still happen? Obviously, it's investment firm to investment firm, but when you see companies pursuing growth or venture pursuing growth, but the business never really had solid unit economics or business to withstand, the conversations we're having with our companies as an early stage is, you know, it's not a moment of panic. Some of the best companies rise to these moments. Again, we're at a completely different stage and cycle than where you sit. But when you look at some of the headlines of, you know, the unicorn of yesterday laying off 30% of its headcount, these like kind of horrific stories, you've been reading the same ones. Matt and I always chat and sidebar, like, how does this still happen? Because unfortunately, that's media clickbait for the majority of the industry, and Business Insider gets a hold of it. Next thing you know, the majority of founders are like, oh my God. So to me, for us, it's unfortunate because it's like a few of these bad stories. Do you have any feeling on how these stories continue to happen and manifest when they don't need to?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I consider myself, and I think you do too, like a little bit old school in, you know, how we think about things and business building and investing. You know, honestly, I think it's like what the market rewards at any particular time is what you're going to get. And so, you know, the market was rewarding growth, and it was, you know, if you kind of like a lot of public investors kind of break out these different areas of performance of different types of companies and company categories, and, you know, no surprise, the biggest loser over the course of the last 6 months in the public markets has been a basket of unprofitable tech companies,
mm-hmm.
So high growth companies that were unprofitable. And well, in order to be the biggest loser, you kind of had to be one of the biggest winners previously. So the market was rewarding growth over profitability. And that sentiment shifted, and now it's rewarding profitability over growth. And, you know, that I think what the market is rewarding at any particular time and the psychology of companies is like, well, if I'm a pre-IPO company and the public markets are really rewarding growth, well, guess what? Like, what am I going to invest in? I'm going to invest in growth. And now you're getting, you know, almost no reward for growth. It's really focused on profitability. So what are you going to see? You're going to see a lot of these cost cutting measures, a lot of these things that are going to reverse to back to, you know, what you and I, the three of us would have said, like, well, this is what they should have been doing all the time. Like, you know, it's, yeah, no, but the market was rewarding something different.
And Jamie, I further to that point, I mean, you can understand why founders would have that kind of mentality or would have those in particular incentives based on the market. But isn't that where the professional investor who's, you know, presumably been through a whole bunch of market cycles should say, okay, like I get, like this is getting a little frothy. Like maybe let's be a little more conservative and not try to chase momentum here because these things, you know, typically end and they typically end poorly.
Yeah. I mean, I think like it depends on what style of investor you are. So there's certainly a class of investors where, you know, their LPs invest with them because they want outsized returns because they are a momentum based investor. And that's what, you know, that's their mandate.
Yeah.
And so that's what they'll do. And then there's an entirely different class of investor that focuses on, you know, dividend growth. And so, you know, if your dividends are growing, that's a target. And if you're not, you're not. And so like, so
yeah,
other style.
I get that. I guess the idea of momentum investing is tricky in private markets where you don't necessarily have that much control over the exit, you know? Yep.
It's a dangerous game because it's illegal. Yep. Right. And so, you know, in the public markets, you can change your mind. In the private markets, you know, despite certainly the maturation of the secondary market, which is, you know, vastly deeper than it was, you know, 10 years ago, is still not what I would call a liquid market. And so, you know, it is, you're absolutely right. It's to play momentum in private markets is a dangerous game.
Yep. So if you look at broad market data, like the PitchBook NVCA tech stuff that comes out, you know, fundraising on a record pace for venture funds the first 3 months of this year, and maybe that's changed in the second quarter a bit, but that, and then if you look, I think their dry powder statistics are on a quarter lag. So I think it's as of the end of last year, the most recent one, but that was also, you know, dry powder also at record level and just in an absolute sense, huge level. So it seems funds have money to deploy still. And if the velocity has gone down and the frequency of fundings has gone down, and you've got more companies kind of dialing back on the spend and waiting it out a bit more, do you think that that money just gets deployed more slowly? Do you think it gets deployed elsewhere? Do you think funds are looking for, you know, continuing to look mostly for good new companies like that are maturing into your, you know, your zone versus maybe having to prop up the companies they're already in?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of several different things, and okay, you hit on them. So one, like a lot of the funding announcements, that like 2021 is record year for, you know, fundraising both for companies and for funds, and that, you know, those announcements continued into Q1. I think a lot of those were, you know, done whether they were closed or not in 2021, but continued into the first quarter. But you can't argue that there's still a lot of dry powder existing. So there is a lot of dry powder today. What I think is happening and will happen is we also saw in 2021, and I've heard from a lot of investors in funds, that funds came back in record time. So they deployed what is more traditionally a 2 to 3 year investment period, shrank down to about a year. So they deployed their funds in a year and they came back raising, you know, 2x the same size fund. That goes to your point of there's a lot of dry powder on the sidelines because those new bigger funds were raised, but they were raised with now like, okay, well, we're not going to deploy this, you know, either into this market that we're in today, but not in the same time period. So those, I think you'll see timelines stretch out and they'll revert more towards the mean of call it 2.5 years deployment period versus, you know, 12 months deployment period for a lot of funds over the course of 2020 and 2021. So I think that will happen. So they'll, to answer one part of your question was, I think you'll see timelines for fund deployment stretch out to get time diversity. Like, you know, a lot of people look back on 2021. I wouldn't want to be in the 2021 vintage only fund that only deployed during 2021. So I think they'll go back and try to, you know, now try to get time diversity in some of these vehicles. Although I do think it is a great time to be out with fresh capital investing. You hit on another thing, which is, you know, a lot of firms that have been investing for, you know, 5 years, 10 years longer have existing portfolios that in this funding environment, now that they have to spend, you know, as much time thinking about their existing portfolio companies as they do about, you know, frankly, probably more than making new investments. So if you have like a, you know, the base case scenario a year ago was like, okay, yeah, we're going to launch a fundraise and we'll go out and we'll bring in a new round of capital and, you know, the business plan is fine. Now it's like, well, we might not be able to go out and raise that round of capital right now. So what does that mean? So that means like, okay, well, if we need to extend through this period, like, well, I'm going to do a bridge in this company, I'm going to help this company with their operating plan and tweak things so that they lower their burn significantly. And so I think there's a lot of that going on. So the attention now is not just out looking for new investments. It's, you know, it's as much, if not way more time, and certainly way more time than over the last couple of years, tending to existing portfolio companies. Okay. And it's not just like the, you know, the where there's problems, it's trying to prevent problems that wouldn't have otherwise arose if not for a funding market that's nearly shut.
Right. Right. So I guess along those lines, that I part of the last part of that question was, you know, kind of to get to things that would be really relevant to the founders of our companies, where, you know, our latest stage company at this point, because our first fund's only a couple of years old, is, you know, a Series B, and we've got a bunch of A's in the mix. As they kind of graduate towards your part of the market, do you think that they're, so number one, should they be concerned that funding won't be there? I assume the answer is no, but just, you know, need to ask. And then what do you think your part of the market? I mean, I know you know what you guys think, but like what you guys plus the rest of that, of your kind of peers, what's going to be the most important thing when they're looking at these new companies? You know, is it kind of how far they've gotten revenue wise? Is it growth? Does, you know, how much does growth matter? How much does kind of underlying metrics matter? Profitability, that sort of, you know, or clear path to profitability, et cetera.
Yeah. I mean, I think like the reversion back to some of the fundamentals of, you know, unit economics and like, you know, what's working and is this working and, you know, does this scale? I think the overarching, you know, message is, and I've seen this over the course of my career, the best companies will be able to raise at, you know, and they'll always look pretty expensive, but the best companies will always be able to raise pretty much in any market. And so we sit here now at a moment in time and, you know, who knows how long that this will last, but, you know, we're the best companies that are performing well, that can show consistent growth and positive unit economics, all those things that investors look for, I think that will be fine. I think and there will be capital available. There's a lot of, you know, I wouldn't say it's a deep freeze, but there's a lot of what we just talked about, which is investors that are not out looking for new investments. They're reassessing. A lot of crossover investors that are super focused on the public markets, whether that's because they're tending to a public markets book or because they see better relative value in the public markets today. Like both of those are certainly, you know, viable reasons to be spending all of their time on public markets. So there's a little bit of that, but for the best companies, there will be capital available and there's, you know, active investors out there and we're active. And I know there's lots of others that are too. So I don't think the availability of capital will be a problem for the best companies. The advice that I always give to founders, and this holds true, I think at any stage, but especially in the early stages and especially with founders that haven't raised, you know, five rounds of capital or they haven't, you know, had two companies. I always tell founders to consider a fundraise think of it in two round increments. So if I'm raising an A, it's like, okay, well, what do I need to look like at my B and what's the round that I need to raise in order to get there? And, you know, what are the milestones that I'm going to need to achieve? And, you know, to an earlier part of our conversation, you know, the market was rewarding growth. So a lot of the time the plan was, well, I need to be growing. I need to be at X scale of revenue and I need to be growing at more than, you know, 100%. And, you know, some of those metrics change market to market, and I can't tell you what they're going to be in a year versus what they are now versus what they were a year ago. But I can say that if you're planning for, you know, long-term sustainability in a company, and if you're thinking about it in, you know, that two round context, part of that is what do I need to look like? But also part of that is like, okay, well, I'm not going to try to get the highest valuation that I can possibly get today. If I'm thinking about it in two rounds, set yourself up, like get the right investors involved. Think about it as like, okay, well, if I have raised at the absolute highest valuation today, what are the chances that I'm going to also raise at the absolute highest valuation again? You might, but typically you'll see, you know, those that get overextended, they won't see as much of a step up the next time and the dilution, you know, more or less comes out the same.
Well, you set yourself up a little bit with maybe impossible expectations too. A lot of times I think founders don't necessarily appreciate that, but
that's true. That's a great point.
Yeah.
But, you know, but I think thinking, you know, regardless of what market you're in and what, I mean, it's growth being rewarded or profitability that's being rewarded, like I wouldn't alter the long-term plan based on the short-term market sentiment. So it's not like, oh, I need to be cash flow positive next quarter. Like I'm going to slash spending and I'm going to cut my sales team and I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that. It's like, okay, you might show a profit for a quarter, but you're not going to show like long-term viability. I think planning for the longer term involves having a sensical, you know, operating plan and having, you know, a good unit economics and good growth. And, you know, the market was rewarding outrageous growth. And I don't think it will snap back to that kind of environment, but good steady growth and sustainability in the businesses that can compound over a long period of time will always be attractive. And so, you know, getting to that state is a great place to be.
Jamie, thanks for that. Rounding this out, direct-to-consumer, consumer businesses, buying or selling? And you don't have to answer this from a BAM perspective. I'm going from there, by the way, to Web3, to NFT, to crypto. Go.
So I think there's some interesting pockets of consumer and direct-to-consumer, but I think, you know, that wouldn't be an area where I'm a big buyer today.
Yep. NFTs?
NFTs, I think they have a very interesting longer term use case in the technology. I don't think it's necessarily, at least not for me, it's not the art application that I think is the killer app. I don't think it's the
still some discovery JPEG, there, right?
JPEG application. There's, you know, I think the market has proven that there's viability there, but I don't know that we've seen the killer app yet.
Web 3.
I think every company needs to be paying attention to Web 3. And that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, Bitcoin and Ethereum and crypto tokens. But, you know, Web 3, I think, is going to be a big part of consumer. I think it's going to be a big part of fintech. And I think it's going to, you know, it's going to be part of enterprise. So I think every company should be paying attention.
Do you have a favorite blockchain application of what, from what you've seen so far?
Favorite blockchain application?
I mean, best use of the technology you've seen so far.
I don't think it's fully in practice yet, but I think things around contracts, I always point to like title insurance as like, you know, the blockchain needs to disrupt title insurance, please. So that would be a killer app for me.
I've been saying this to people for years, literally years, because it is the dumbest thing that everybody has to pay for.
Yep.
Anyway.
Couple more, Jamie. Old economy, legacy industries that are ripe for disruption. So the dirty, dull, and dangerous. Oh, wait, that's our thesis. Sorry, just had to get our own little CTV plug there. Finally, the Warriors and Celtics are upon us tomorrow for game 3. You've been out in the Bay Area for a while. I still consider you an East Coast guy. So talk to me about where you think this shakes out. Who wins? How many games does it go?
So I'll work backwards. I think it goes the full 7.
Me too.
I've been very impressed by, as you know, I grew up as a Celtics fan. Mm-hmm. I was, you know, out behind the old Boston guy, mm-hmm. asking D Brown for his signature.
Mm-hmm. Oh, nice.
D Brown. The old school.
The original Reebok pumps and the, yeah.
The Reebok pumps. It was amazing. But yeah, I've been in the Bay Area for 16 years now, I guess, maybe a little bit longer than that. I would say there's like a pretty strong fan base out here. We love our Warriors out here, I have to say. You know, there's so much talent on both teams, and I'm really impressed. I'm really, frankly, I was surprised at the comeback in game 1 and was really impressed by it. I think it goes the full 7.
Who do you want to win?
I mean, I think that...
Say it out loud, Jamie. Say it out loud. You'll feel better.
I'm going to say what? The Bay Area has been beaten down for the last couple of years, and we need a win. So I...
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Oh, no. And Matt, we love Jamie until this moment. Oh, my God. Oh, wait. No.
45 minutes in, it all went sideways on us.
All right, Jamie, you're on, bud. I'll be texting a little bit for some side action. Thanks for tuning in to another edition to In the Trenches. Jamie, thanks so much for bringing your experience and wisdom to the table in these moments. And hopefully our audience gets some good value out of this conversation. So be well out there. Go Celtics. Thanks for tuning in.
Thanks, Jamie.
Great. Thanks, guys. Enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the Superpowers Podcast Show, friends. Please be sure to check out superpowerspodcast.com or on Instagram, superpowerspod. Be sure to tell a friend, subscribe, like. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.